Hello, everyone. Welcome to Open the Pod Bay Doors. My name is Faiton Snow, and I'm going to be your host today. I'm one of the co-founders of Innovation Bay, along with Ian Gardner. This podcast is brought to you by Innovation Bay. We're a global network of tech founders, investors, and connectors, and our aim is to support founders on their journey from idea to IPO and beyond. We've been doing this a long time, since 2003, and we're active with over 5,000 members. Now, if you're interested in connecting, learning, and building relationships with other tech founders and investors, check us out and become a member. You can apply for membership at innovationbay.com. This week, I'm talking to Nick Carter, Senior Vice President of Energy, Technology and Solutions at Macquarie Bank. Nick works across a range of areas from energy storage to renewable energy solutions and more. He's an engineer by training with an undergraduate from Swinburne University and a master's degree from Melbourne University. He's worked around the world for companies like Toyota, Holden and Tesla and has a real passion for EVs and the impact that they can make. Now, just before we jump into this, I want to let you know that April is all about how we in the startup industry are coming up with energy solutions to address the impact of climate change. This is leading into a very special breakfast event that we're running at Airtree Ventures offices on Tuesday, the 20th of April, which will have a focus on how startups are using big data to predict and address the impact of climate change, which we're partnering on with IAG Firemark Ventures. Now, you can register for this event via our website and either attend in person or join us on the live video stream. Now, one very simple way for us to dramatically impact climate change is to convert our existing diesel fleets over to electric. The technology is here and available today. So today's podcast is going to be all about talking with Nick around the immediate opportunities for renewables on mass transportation and the opportunities that that, in end, will create for the local entrepreneurs and investors. So if you're a listener, you might remember that Ian interviewed Nick last year, which was a much more broad-ranging podcast around renewable trends, which was super exciting. And that was leading into our annual Arena Renewable Energy Dinner, which we again will be running this year in September. So the conversation today includes a lot of talk about electric buses, ferries, hydrogen trains and buses, but mostly focuses on EVs and how this is going to kind of evolve. If you look at countries like China and towns like, or cities like Shenzhen, who've just converted 16,000 of their buses over to electric and 22,000 of their taxis. We're also seeing mass adoption in the US and obviously in Europe. It's a very exciting trend for us and unveils a number of great opportunities for the Australian economy. So let's jump into it with Nick and see where we go. Nick Carter, welcome to Open the Pod Bay Doors again.
Thank you very much. Yeah. Pleasure to be here.
And instead of doing it in April last year in Sydney, we're doing it this time in Hobart, Tasmania.
Absolutely. What a place. Fantastic weather. Raining everywhere else. It's terrific.
That's right. Torrential rain in Sydney. So I thought we'd just kick off this conversation, given the fact that you were on the show a year ago, which was fantastic, and talking about renewable energy, about what's sort of happened in the last year. With a specific focus, today's conversation is going to be about mass transportation.
Yep.
Any of these.
Yeah, so I think a few things have happened. I think probably the main one is a lot of governments globally, but also in Australia, state and federal, have really started to make some inroads in terms of policy development. I think we've seen various roadmaps, technology roadmaps come out. Those roadmaps are really starting to absorb hydrogen and electric and transportation, given that transportation, you know, roughly 30% of our total emissions in Australia. It's really started to look at some of those things. I think you could argue there's a way to go on the policy for electric vehicles, but I think we're really probably the most surprising change has been the commercial vehicle space. And so a few things like the Sydney Transit Authority have come out with some strong wording and policy around procuring, you know, electric and hydrogen buses. And that whole space has really started to take off. So I think that's a trend that we're seeing overseas, but also washing into Australia now.
Sure.
And then probably the other big one is in that exact space is Joe Biden's announcement as soon as he got in that he was going to electrify the US fleet of government vehicles, which is a pretty big call.
Yeah.
But what that means is all of those yellow school buses that you see, you know, in movies and whatever, they're all government owned, or a lot of them are, and they all have to be electric in, you know, six, seven years. So that transition in itself is really starting to push the whole world to think about, you know, electrification and hydrogen for that type of transport.
It's a really significant move too, isn't it? Because it's something that you might have historically seen come out of China with their centralized system of how they can do that. And I noticed that, you know, a lot of Chinese
towns now moved to electric mass transport.
Yep.
Which absolutely. And they can do that. But I wonder how it will roll out in America.
Yeah, it's a good point. Going back to your question about what's changed, like previously, if you had have asked me, I would have said, well, China was the leader, and they probably still are today with electric buses and electric commercial vehicles. But I think these announcements now are really setting the scene to for the US in particular to really play catch up.
Yeah.
And I guess that has a flow-on effect as well, because a lot of the companies that provide batteries or other pieces of the powertrain and the technology there are going to really scale up now. Yeah. And that includes, you know, the Tesla Semi, for example, like that's going to get probably even more traction.
Right.
Some of the other manufacturers, like some of the fuel cell guys, it's all starting to, you can just sort of feels like we're at compared to, 12 months ago, we're at the point where it's starting to kick up a little bit, at least at the global level.
Yeah.
But we are seeing some of that wash through in Australia as well.
Yeah, it's super interesting, isn't it? I noticed there were some connotations around this as a comparable time, maybe, you know, 100 years ago to, or 100, more than 100 years ago when we went from a horse to a car. Do you see that?
I actually do. Not so much from, I guess, the step change in that particular technology. Where I see electric vehicles, whether it's commercial or passenger vehicles, having a massive impact is in the energy system.
Right.
So I think the biggest change we've seen, you know, since we started burning coal or having steam engines or whatever, is solar.
Mm.
Rooftop solar, particularly residential rooftop, is having a really big impact on the national electricity market. It has a big impact on the pricing. It has a big impact on the grid and grid stability and all those things. That's a huge, huge step change. And I think the next one we're going to see is electric vehicles because that's, you know, a big delta. It completely shifts the load, when the people want to use electricity, what time of day, how flexible that load is, how does it integrate with that rooftop solar?
Right.
You know, are you parked your electric vehicle at work? Is it at home? Is it using the sun on the roof there and all of that stuff, and the business models that tie all that together, I think is just a huge, huge, huge change.
And a lot of opportunity, I think, for massive, the startup ecosystem too.
Huge opportunity.
To back of that. We're going to talk about that a little bit later. One thing I just wanted to finish on is that I kind of feel like I'm really lucky to advise a LiDAR business in Sydney, Braha, that's doing really well, which is great. And being part of their journey, it feels like that sometimes you're on a yo-yo with the take up of EV, but also autonomous vehicles. And I noticed that an Alibaba-backed Chinese company, AutoX, has now released a fully autonomous robo-taxi in China. I'd just love your thoughts on that aspect of adoption.
Yep.
I also saw a McKinsey report that said, which is hard for me to believe, but maybe 80% of all travel, all miles taken in Europe, North America and China by 2030 will be in a fully autonomous vehicle.
Mm. So that's a great topic. I've got a few different views. If I put my automotive engineering hat back on and think about the control systems and the software and the hardware in the vehicle that's required to actually do real fully autonomous driving, it's hard, like really hard. It's hard from a safety perspective. It's hard from making it robust. You know, so even if one in 10,000 times it thinks that a school kid crossing the road is actually not a school kid, then that's a problem.
Yeah.
And getting to that level of robustness is really tough. There have been huge gains. You know, Tesla's had various levels of autonomy for quite a while. Some of the companies you mentioned as well. I think it's going to take, I'd love to be wrong, but I think it might take a bit longer than that.
Right.
I think it will happen though. So your second point is what happens when it does start to become a mass adoption thing. That's going to be probably the third big step change after the actual introduction of EVs itself. I think the whole mobility modes will just change, I think.
Right.
Because buses will become autonomous in some way. you know, your Uber will become autonomous. Your own passenger vehicle that you buy will have a button which will make it autonomous.
Yeah.
Ride sharing models change. Lots of opportunity for innovation.
Car ownership,
obviously. Car ownership models completely change.
And do you think the driving force behind what we're seeing at the moment with this move to EVs is about decarbonisation of the, of the planet? Is that what's the key driver?
I think it is at the highest level. The other things that are also very important are things like tailpipe emissions. So even though modern petrol and diesel vehicles have got, you know, relatively stringent tailpipe emission standards, there's still things like particulates, you know, smoke, all those things have a big impact on health.
Right.
And then the other one is actually cost. And the fourth, or I can't remember what I'm up to, the third most more nuanced one is really that integration with the grid.
Right.
How does the electric vehicle integrate with the grid? How does it soak up excess solar?
Yeah.
How does it offer grid services? Mm. How does it participate in the energy market? Like that's where the action is. Arena have funded at least one or two different trials now looking at frequency control,
right,
ancillary services using a fleet of EVs.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the stuff we're talking about. If you mix that in a big mixing bowl with autonomy,
yeah,
like it's a pretty big deal.
No congestion. It would be pretty exciting to see sort of that.
It would be. Bike riders would be safer.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Yeah. I think you talk about the Prime Minister at the moment, I know we're a little bit of a tangent now, seems to be, you know, there seems to be a little bit of a scare campaign about, you know, tradies won't own their utes and, you know, won't have your ute on the weekend, but it's not really about that, is it?
No, I think it's not really about that. I think people will, once those products are available, perceptions will shift. I mean, there's some pretty cool electric utes available in the States.
They are. I was looking at the Rivian one. It's so exciting. And I also noticed, and obviously your ex-Tesla, that Tesla are coming out with a very affordable kind of car. I'm not sure if they've released it yet or they're about to.
I don't think they have.
Yeah. Mm. But they're sort of saying $20,000-$25,000 US. Mm. The US, which probably means like 100 grand in Australia. By the time we pay tax on it. But no, seriously, probably something 30 or 40 grand in Australia maybe. Mm.
Yeah, that's right. So I think we're starting to get there. Some big announcements last week around Volkswagen and how they're going to really accelerate the, I think their electric version of the Golf.
Right.
Which they've had for a while. I think they're up to sort of Gen 2, Gen 3.
Yeah.
That's going to be, like, they're putting all their eggs in that basket as well. So right. They're trying to have made statements around knocking off Tesla
right.
as the number one selling EV. And so you can just see now that you've got Volkswagen getting more aggressive, Tesla's always aggressive, Hyundai and others. So it's I think we're at the bottom of the knee point.
Definitely the Tesla market cap now would suggest that we're at the tipping point, I guess.
Indeed.
Okay, so let's just talk a little bit more about the electrification of the transport system and the opportunities maybe that kind of presents. I think you're thinking, you're looking at it as a step change.
Mm.
Talk to us a little bit about that.
Again, it comes back for me in terms of the economics around the step change in terms of being able to connect it to the grid.
Right.
I think that's really important.
And at the moment, we've got a bunch of diesel buses that are driving everyone around or gas-powered buses, I think, sometimes.
Yeah, there's a lot of natural gas buses in Australia as well. Yeah, so it's natural gas and diesel fleet primarily. I think there is an opportunity to decarbonize that whole transport, public transport sector. There's a lot of capital required. You know, buses aren't cheap. There's a lot of infrastructure. Getting that infrastructure mix right, whether it's hydrogen or electric, is really important.
Charging stations.
Charging stations or hydrogen refueling stations. There's a lot of considerations depending on the route. Is it charging, you know, does it have less battery pack or energy on the bus and it charges on route, or does it return to base with a bigger battery? All of those considerations are complex, but I think that's where the step change is going to come in that area. I think in Australia we're going to see commercial vehicles being the place that electrification happens first.
Right.
not passenger vehicles.
Okay. And so why is that, do you think?
I think there's just going to be more focus, more government support.
Is there more supply from a manufacturing point of view?
Yeah. So we've got actually a few different bodybuilders and manufacturers in Australia now that make buses.
Right.
A lot of them are looking closely at this and actually produce them now. So we've got, you know, companies like Bus Tech in South Australia who make an electric model. And of course, here in Hobart, there's a lot of Bus Tech buses driving around for Metro.
Yeah.
Volgren and others have got electric offerings as well. So, I think we're very, very lucky here. We've got actual people that make things, and they happen to make buses, and they happen to make electric buses and hydrogen versions of the bus, which is great.
So I think we were talking to one of the Zoox investors a while back when Zoox, before the acquisition, and they were talking about, you know, Zoox was going to be that robo-taxi kind of model. But the cost of rolling it out to a city like LA, for example, was in the kind of $40 billion range, just from a point of view of charging localities and the volume of cars, and they're obviously very heavy on the tech side.
Yep.
What does it look like from a mass transport?
I think it's, to your point, like, it's not going to be one mode.
Yeah.
I think in the future, I'm not sure exactly how far that is, we're going to have electric or hydrogen buses or trackless trams, depending on which city you come from in Australia. Right. That's going to be almost like a backbone. We're, of course, going to continue having electric trains. I think you're then going to have this weird mix of private vehicles, ride-sharing vehicles, electric hireable bikes, last mile sort of services, scooters. You know, I was in Adelaide 2 weeks ago going to meetings using my electric scooter that I swipe my card on. All those, everything from sort of the big stuff right down to the last mile, I think is going to completely change. And to the Zoox point, you know, the integration of that is really important. And there's a lot of opportunities for software and other companies to integrate across that chain. So, you know, how do you have a seamless, you know, get on your bus, get in the car, get on your scooter.
Yeah.
That whole chain is effectively the holy grail.
And I know obviously buses are kind of energy intensive, but I understand the range of, like, a lot of electric buses, 200 or 300 kilometres. They're not going to do that in a day. So the ability charge at night when no one's using them, which is also off peak for grid, isn't it? So that does kind of work quite well.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's right. I mean, you can get quite a lot of energy on a bus now with modern batteries that they're using.
Right.
And to your point, that's a big battery on wheels.
Yeah. And so, therefore, the impact upon the grid is actually works quite well, because, again, there's a lot of concerns I've seen in the press about, well, we couldn't all move to EV because we'd just blow the grid up.
That's right.
But that's not kind of...
That's not how it would work in reality when we're further down the track. I think the same argument was made with passenger vehicles, which is, and it's true, if there's a street with one distribution transformer and everyone in that street buys a Tesla Model 3 and they all come home and plug them in, you'll trip that transformer and that street will go black. That's a fact.
Yeah.
But as we get more and more of these things deployed, the way you charge them, we call that dumb charging. That's an EV industry term, dumb charging. We're not going to do dumb charging. You're going to have some level of smartness in terms of how much power is it drawing? Is it integrated into the distribution operator?
Right.
Is it integrated into the energy market? Is it integrated into your home battery?
Yeah.
You want to gamify your charging of your vehicle to, you know, oh, the price is low, charge.
Right.
Oh, the price is going to go high, stop charging. Scheduling, all that stuff. You can schedule a Model 3 or a Tesla now, right, on your app. So you don't have to charge it full whack.
So for our community, which are entrepreneurs and investors, this is a really interesting point, I think, in some ways, because maybe it's just me, but I kind of think, you know, PowerPoint, plug it in, but there is a lot of nuance to it and a lot of opportunity in the charging infrastructure aspect.
Absolutely.
We've seen that with some of our arena renewable energy dinner applications.
Yep. Lots of opportunity.
What do you think the opportunities are there?
I think it goes from as simple as charging management. You know, what happens if you have a fleet of Nissan Leafs for a nursing fleet? How are you going to balance those and not just take maximum out of the grid?
Right.
How do you, if you charge that vehicle at point A but drive it and plug it in at point B and it's got excess energy, you know, when do you charge at point B? Maybe you don't charge at all. So there's, even though it's plugged in, so there's
right.
That whole system, ecosystem and optimization is really important.
And then I also noticed there's fast chargers, you know,
dumb charging.
You know, so how much nuance is there in the technology of actually the physical charge that goes across?
Well, I mean, you've got different levels of charging.
Yeah.
You know, and it goes up, you know, initially as AC charging, and then you start to get super high power DC fast charging,
right,
which is different again. You got wireless charging. So that's gaining more and more momentum, especially in North America, where you've got two coils and you park the vehicle over the top and, you know, guides you into the pad, like with crosshairs, like you're parking a plane.
Yeah, wow.
And it'll charge without any contactless charging. So there's a lot of hardware and software innovations. And I think probably the biggest gap, if you think about buses, for example, as a commercial vehicle fleet, is really that route optimization with charging, and that whole integration piece is actually an area, I think, globally that's not super advanced. There are companies that have started working on that and are raising capital to develop that, but it's not right. It's not something you just come up with a list of five people.
Gotcha.
It's so that whole thing's really important because it is all one ecosystem. You can't just, you know, do dumb charging and then you go, okay, now I'm doing smart charging now.
Yeah.
But you're not reflecting what's happening on the routes. How much energy does it actually need? When does that bus need to go back out?
Mm.
Is it only going out for 2 hours? So the whole scheduling, charging, rates of charging, when to charge, integration with the energy market is a really big problem that a lot of people are going to have a crack at, and they need to.
It's an efficiency question, I guess, at the end of the day. And I guess if people are connected through a smart app to when they want to, you know, hail a bus or get a rideshare or whatever, then the intel that we can start to build across that of user behavior, which they're doing now.
Correct.
To help inform us on bus schedules or whatnot.
Exactly. And the algorithm is effectively, to your point, you know, how do I deliver transport across these different domains within these constraints at the lowest cost? And it's just constantly trying to do that.
It's really interesting, isn't it? And so are you seeing, out of curiosity, any innovative Australian companies that are starting to tackle this at all? Or
there are a few. Yeah. There's also lots of overseas people. There's probably actually not that many people with their arms fully around this in Australia yet.
Will it be a unique solution for Australia as a region, you know, like left-hand, right-hand drive, or will it be ambiguous across geographies?
I reckon what you'll get, and this is already emerging, you're probably going to have a relatively generic package for fleet management.
Right.
For commercial fleets, might be different package for buses versus trucks, but you're going to have a fleet piece of software that's going to integrate with the charging system. The bit that's going to have to be a plug-in, which is different, is how do you integrate it into each energy market?
Right.
Because our energy market in Australia is unique and different to California, which is different to the UK, which is different to Japan. And I think that piece needs to be interchangeable, but probably the other layers in the stack could be relatively generic once they're built. But it is very bespoke. Like, it's a lot of customization. You know, what buses, how they're being used.
And I think
big problem.
And I think from a price point of view, just out of curiosity, I was reading somewhere about, you know, charging an EV is about $15 or maybe $20 for a full tank compared to petrol, obviously. So it's a fairly significant.
It's a big delta.
It's a big delta, especially if you're annualizing. Okay.
That's right.
What about vehicle telematics? You know, you mentioned that before, so out of curiosity.
Very important, again, in the context of the commercial electric or hydrogen fleet. Vehicle telematics is super important. because, as we were just saying, it integrates into that layer to say, okay, this bus is, you know, dropping in energy. My model says that it's going to have to go back and get recharged at some rate because it has to go back out.
Right.
It needs to have that information in order to have a future view or a future forecast. Otherwise, you can't really make it optimal. So that's one piece that that vehicle telematics will be very important for. Of course, all the other stuff like, you know, smart asset management, smart maintenance is part of it. But actually for electric, probably one area that again is a fantastic area for software folks and investors to be working on and thinking about. And there are a few people doing this is things like active state of health of the battery.
Right.
And the fleet. So the concept would be as an asset finance person for a fleet, you need to have a really good view of the residual value of that fleet.
Mm.
And if you're talking about a battery electric fleet, how do you take a view?
Because it's a huge
year
asset.
Five, exactly, huge amounts of money. Year five, year 10, what's my actual fleet state of health look like? And so there's people like Bosch, for example, who have developed a state of health algorithm,
right,
using the vehicle telemetry to predict and forecast how that battery is going to look over time.
Yeah, right.
In that vehicle, based on the use cases that you've got. That all then feeds back into the optimization as well.
Right.
Because you don't want to flog, you know, this bus over here is getting flogged, this one's not.
Gotcha.
I need to do something to manage that degradation of the overall fleet because that's, again, the lowest cost.
And I would have thought the battery is probably one of the most significant costs of an EV.
Roughly 50%, yeah.
And they last for about, I think, what, 15 years, is that right?
Or? They're getting longer. So if you apply it to, say, stationary storage, which a lot of the manufacturers and chemistries are similar to stationary storage, stationary batteries are getting out to sort of 15 to 20 years now in terms of a warranted life.
Right.
The use case, of course, with vehicles is different. The vehicles are much harsher environment. It's got to go over bumps and higher power charging and all this sort of stuff. So, but they are getting up there.
Mm.
So you're starting to get out to sort of, you know, 6, 8, 10 years. And I think as more fleets get on the road and the chemistries and batteries keep improving, that'll just push out as well.
Right. Macquarie's got a great financing to the business. Mm. And as we look at, you know, the transition from diesel or gas carbon-based transport systems to electric, then how are you looking at that from a point of view of actually funding it?
Yeah.
And helping the transition across?
Great leading question. So I think the way we're thinking about it is that all that stuff that we just discussed, you know, what types of charge points, how do I optimize the routes of those vehicles?
Yeah.
What types of vehicles? What's the state of health of the battery? How does the battery degrade? What software do I need? How do I get the power into the depot if it's a return to base fleet? Do I need on-route charging or depot charging?
Mm.
Where do I get my energy from? Which retailer am I going to use? What's the contract look like for the energy? All of those things are individually hard in themselves. If you're trying to do the whole lot, that's really hard.
Yeah.
And that's actually probably the key barrier to a lot of, you know, commercial vehicle operators, governments and others to do that and crack that nut. What we would like to do is effectively put our arms around that whole problem and wrap it together into a single offer. And so what that means is that it becomes a dollar per kilometer,
right,
offering for a single package, which we think is compelling. And if you, the other key there is in order to do that at the lowest cost of capital and raise, you know, money and raise debt against that kind of fleet, by having Macquarie interface each of those components together in a way that is bankable or investable,
right,
is really important. Because at the moment you've got people trying to, you know, they might get a vehicle lease, but then they have to talk to someone else about charge points.
Right.
How does the charging of the vehicle impact the lease and maybe it doesn't, and but they're going to charge you more money for the lease because they can't value the degradation of the battery and so on. And you end up with a potentially inefficient solution. So we're trying to offer an end-to-end solution that's a dollar per kilometre charge.
Because again, it's a significant step change, isn't it? We're not going to see like a Hydro TAS petrol station available. Shell obviously manufacture and then distribute, but we're going to see it more fractionalised, aren't we, in terms of energy provider. And then there seems to be a myriad of charging ports. And I know the government's talking about, well, service stations now need to start to offer
Electric charging.
But I'd like to think about, how do you see that? Because I know the federal government's come out and said, we're not going to subsidize car prices, EV car prices. But they've talked about investing in charging ports. I'm not sure if they've come out with any policy of that yet. I think they're saying mid-year or something.
Yeah.
But, you know, if we look at places like Norway, which has got the highest adoption of EVs per capita in the world, then charging ports seem to be really significant.
Yeah. Yep. There's a few things there. I think one is ARENA are funding the rollout of public charging points through companies like, you know, ChargeFox and so on. So that is happening. And it's actually, when you look at that, a pretty good coverage now across the eastern states and Tasmania.
Right.
But
nowhere near like service stations, obviously.
No. But I think this is the key point. Is I hate going to the service station.
Yeah.
One of the main reasons I would love to have an EV is so that I don't have to go to a service station.
Yeah.
And so I think what's going to happen is you're going to do a lot of your charging at home.
Right.
You're going to do some charging maybe at your workplace if you've got a workplace that has a charging station. And occasionally you're going to use a public charger.
Right.
If you go on a road trip, you're going to use a public charger to get there. Does it have to be in a servo? Maybe. It does take some time to do it, but I don't think it has to be a servo. I think these ChargeFox and other models look quite successful. And, you know, the Tesla supercharger network is another example where it's not a servo necessarily.
Yeah.
Might be co-located.
Yeah.
Might have a shop. But it doesn't have to be a servo. And they're only really used for some of the time, those longer journeys.
Sure. And it would probably suit well like supermarkets where you can go in, buy groceries or whatever for 10 or 15 minutes and come out.
Exactly. Because
even though the times are coming down, it's still 10 minutes-ish before you-
That's right.
You know.
Exactly. So it's a different model. I don't want to sit at a servo for 20 minutes.
Yeah. But we're not seeing a lot of supermarkets, are we? It's interesting that opportunity is not maybe being leveraged.
Bubbled up enough. I think that's right. The other key point, though, I would make, which I think is a historical kind of fact whenever it comes to vehicle energy sources, is, you know, what comes first, infrastructure or vehicles? And historically, it's always vehicles.
Right.
So the more vehicles you get on the roads, the more these other things get built out. It's very rare that you'll build out, you know, a million charge points and then go, okay, where are the cars?
Which is why a lot of other governments have stimulated or reduced the price of EVs to incentivize people, either through registration or cost of vehicle.
Right.
So if we don't do that in Australia,
we're just going to have a much slower uptake for passenger vehicles.
Okay. So let's just talk about the charging infrastructure because we want to talk about that, right? And
sure.
So, you know, you talked about dumb charging house. How does that change? And then how do we support that?
Most of it is around the software.
Right.
In terms of a lot of charge points now, even a very basic household, relatively low power charger can adjust its power.
Right.
So, you know, it can be full power, it can be lower power.
You don't need phase three power into your house or anything like that.
You can have a much higher power three-phase system or charger, but I think even a single phase.
Right. Would work.
20 amp system is pretty common. That's what most people have today with their EV. Even that, as I said before, a great example is the Tesla app and vehicle and integration to the charge point.
Right.
You can adjust the power up and down, can turn off, can turn on. even that basic functionality is where it's at.
Right.
There are opportunities for software.
So you don't need to go and buy a $5,000 charging port to install at your house.
No, that level one charger is actually relatively cheap.
So it's the technology that sits on top of that.
Correct. Okay. It's the interface into it. So a lot of them just have an IP address. You can ping commands to it.
Right.
And some providers are starting to offer software to do that.
Okay.
But a basic charger installed is, less than $1,000.
So a house is going to need more power.
Mm.
And solar seems like the natural. Is that what the opportunity is?
I think so, yeah. So solar, residential solar, battery, EV.
Right.
That's the combo.
Because even though Australia has a really high penetration per capita of solar, I haven't read this, but I would just hazard a guess that there's probably not a lot of batteries associated with that solar.
Relative to the amount of solar, that's right.
Yeah.
But I think we're actually... The number of household batteries is really starting to ramp. Schemes like Victoria have got the battery home subsidy scheme and South Australia and others, and it's really starting to get there. I don't know how we look actually on a battery only comparison to other places in the world per capita.
Right.
We're definitely not last, but on a distributed energy resource or decentralized energy ratio, meaning how much energy is produced, not at the central power stations, but on roofs and in homes, we've got the highest in the world.
And I know in the last show, we talked about kind of micro grids.
Yeah.
Right. Is that where it's at? I mean, if a suburb was fully connected with solar and batteries, how self-sustaining is that suburb? Depending upon where it sits, obviously.
Yeah. I mean, this trend of micro gridding, which effectively means not being connected to the main network, that is something that in regional and rural areas is actually happening more and more.
Right.
To your point, if you do inject into that township lots of electric vehicles,
be an issue.
Well, it's an opportunity and an issue because you've got that additional control.
Right.
You've got batteries on wheels to soak up excess solar, but ultimately you need the energy, which means you're going to need a lot of solar or a wind farm or some other source.
Right.
But that's a trend that's happening. Whether we'll get to the point where, suburbs like the one we're sitting in now will have some kind of microgrid, probably not. I think once you're connected to the main grid it's robust, it's pretty hard to shift from that. I think if you're in a regional town that keeps going offline because the power line falls over, that's a different use case.
Is there going to be much more innovation in solar? Or are we maxed out in solar? Or is it going to be the battery technology that overtakes that? Or what is that? And efficiency in the house?
I tend to look at the cost curves for these things. And if you look at the cost curve for solar, it's been dropping like a stone for the last 10 or 15 years, but it is starting to, by definition, kind of plateau a little bit. There are always innovations around new inverters, new types of cells, but generally speaking, the cost curve has really come down. Batteries are just starting to really drop a lot too, or cell pricing. So I think probably in 5 years, the battery will be a lot more competitive and a lot more people will have them.
So going back to our previous point, we were talking about the application kind of layer is a significant of opportunity. Is that same with these microgrids?
Yeah.
And how to balance load and when to transfer power where and how to manage it?
Yeah, I think a lot of large commercial microgrids, there's a lot of providers that do that software already for microgrids.
Right.
Microgrids have been around for quite a while. So you've got all of the Schneiders, Siemens, type of players that offer that software.
Right. Okay. And so do you think that that will supplement the growth in EVs over time? So I guess the question comes back to how do we support a mass transition over the next 5 years to electric vehicles?
Well, luckily, our adoption of EVs is so slow that I think we're going to have lots of solar and storage by the time everyone gets a vehicle. So for us, it just happens to be that I don't think that's going to be too much of an issue.
Right.
But we will need smart charging. that would be a prerequisite. You can't just install all this stuff without that. Yeah.
And it also seems like there's a huge amount of innovation that's going into power management within homes, in residential homes now, with things like double, triple glazing, LED lights. You know, definitely in Tassie, I'm very conscious of the fact that not many people have double glazing, but they've mandated it now. You know, it's just a retrofit thing. So it seems like there's a lot of energy savings that are going to evolve over the next decade.
As we
make a transition.
Well, fundamental energy savings have been very important for the energy system for a long time. And, you know, that's a huge, if you're actually going to achieve zero carbon, that's a fundamental thing you just have to do as well.
Yeah.
Building like this would be hard.
So going back then, you know, to a fundamental question of our audience, entrepreneurs and investors, where do you see the opportunities then in this space?
I think there's a lot of opportunities, whether it's commercial vehicles or passenger vehicles, for route optimization, fleet scheduling, smart charging integrations, all of those software layers, I think, is where the real innovation is. There are, of course, people doing hardware as well. Autonomous vehicle software and hardware is another massive growth area as well, which I think people should keep an eye on.
I know perception is kind of a really tricky one about how does the LiDAR interpret all the data and make meaning out of it? Seems like a very difficult question. It is.
Yeah, it's a hard one.
I think so.
But, you know, there are companies like AEV Robotics in Melbourne that are making a great product as an electric, you know, autonomous platform. That's where the action is, I think.
It's a very exciting opportunity. And I know we've got to talk about it, right? EV versus hydrogen. I know Tassie's kind of going nuts on hydrogen at the moment, it's a future export potential for Tassie. How do you see that? Because it seems like hydrogen is still a very emerging technology.
Well, actually, hydrogen and fuel cells and electrolyzers have been around for a really long time, you know, pre-World War II type stuff. World War II, people used to make hydrogen from various sources to power certain devices, especially during the war. So that stuff's fairly common. There's actually, I think, a Norwegian electrolyzer that was built in the 30s and it was huge. Right. So there's that kind of stuff exists. I think the rate of change of electric now, with battery cell pricing continuing to evolve, you know, Moore's law is absolutely playing out in batteries. But I think to answer your question specifically, I think it's horses for courses. So, you know, these are generic statements. If you need a higher power, potentially longer range solution, you may look to hydrogen. If you're using maybe a slightly less range, maybe not the power requirement, it's possibly electric, but they're quite generic statements. And if you drew a diagram, there'd be quite a bit of overlap in the middle.
I was reading somewhere that Airbus has come out, or they're working on a hydrogen-based
aircraft.
Is that where you see the applications in those sort of areas?
I think so, except it sort of then becomes more of a physics problem around, can you make synthetic jet fuel from hydrogen, which you can, as opposed to having hydrogen tanks on the aircraft. And I think we're going to have Jet A and other fuels that are fossil fuels now, possibly being replaced by syn fuels or synthetic fuels over time, which are hydrogen based.
Oh, interesting.
So you could make green Jet A, for example.
Yeah.
But that takes a whole ecosystem and economy to be built around it to make it economic.
Okay. So why don't we talk about maybe some of the impacts for Australia as we kind of move, and how you see it playing out, you know? How is this going to change the energy systems in Australia and how the energy players interact with consumers and also private sector?
I think, and you're already seeing this now with a lot of energy companies in Australia, have got EV-related projects, and that, you know, there's a clear reason for that, because it is a battery on wheels.
Yeah.
It's additional demand, which is, you know, controllable. Demand is, you know, I think last year dropped, which is not good because people are putting on more solar and putting double glazing in. So demand is doing that, going down. And, you know, by putting an EV in, it goes back up. So right. that's a good solution for a demand problem. Okay. I think you're going to see commercial vehicle operators, particularly buses to start with, and governments supporting that rollout for electrification or hydrogen buses, then trucks, I think is the progression.
It has to be a massive, significant impact to their bottom line just from the pricing of fuel, which would be a really big part of the equation. Right? We had Olympia Yaga on the show a little while ago, and she was talking about, you know, the cost of food transportation is so significant for farmers. Yeah,
that's right. And the other one, which we haven't talked about, is around the fuel, is energy security.
Right.
So we're pretty lucky here. I don't think we've got huge amounts of fuel in storage if something did go wrong, and then you just have to look to the South China Sea and potential conflict in that area, which would be, you know, potential big problem for our fuel supply. So if you've then got essential, what I would call essential services like public transport running off the grid or running off hydrogen that's made in the state using the grid, you're self-sufficient. I think that's a big part of it that people are starting to really recognise as well. Right.
Macquarie obviously investing really heavily into renewables. It's a major vertical for the business. And a couple of years ago, we had Mike Cannon-Brookes at an arena event talking about the Sun Cable project, for example. Mm. And, you know, someone asked him, I think, why don't we just turn the cable to Sydney? Wouldn't it power Sydney? And he was like, yeah, it would. Then why aren't we doing it? He goes, well, the federal government don't want it, so to speak. So there's a lot of questions in the market around, can we ever be 100% renewable? Is that feasible? Is it not? What happens when the, you know, the wind stops blowing? How do you see this?
I think one thing to say up front we should recognise is that the Australian NEM, or National Electricity Market, is a pretty good thing. Like it's not a third world grid. Like it's a good grid. It was obviously built for a purpose, which was around centralized fossil fuel generation. So I don't think it's necessarily a matter of just plugging in, you know, Sun Cable. I think what we've got is a really good building block, but it needs to evolve and move away from the centralized sort of generation that we've currently got into a grid that can support much higher renewable penetration and much less sort of spinning mass-based thermal generation.
Right.
And that's the transition. That's the energy transition right there. And it's already happening. We're seeing, you know, public announcements of coal generators closing. We've got, Yallourn announced a couple of weeks ago that it's going to close early.
Right.
There's a lot of pressure on them to close just from economics. But it is that grid transition, and it's going to take a lot of investment to make it robust.
And from what I'm picking up with the conversation we've had today, you know, it feels like there's a lot of renewable energy generation out there, whether that's solar or wind or pumped hydro or whatever that might be. The opportunity is really around the management of those systems and the utilization of how it engages with the grid.
Yes, that's right. And storage is going to be a very key role for that, as well as, you know, the storage on the vehicles.
Do you see, you know, we're in a COVID world at the moment, right? Everyone's working remote. I'm not sure if the Macquarie team is still remote or they're coming back slowly, but we've heard a lot of companies aren't going back, some are going back. This is obviously affecting real estate in the CBDs and different areas. Do you see this as an opportunity to transition to charging stations, or is Macquarie looking at that or not really?
Not really on a passenger vehicle side. Yeah. I think
because they've got to be remote, they've got to be out.
Yeah, that's right. I think from a commercial vehicle perspective, we are seeing, you know, a lot of movement there for electric and hydrogen.
Yeah.
Mm.
Okay. You talk about indigenous need for battery cells.
Mm. Well, I guess that's a fancy way of saying, why aren't we making our own battery cells in Australia? And it's something that's keeps bubbling up from time to time, because people say, well, we're digging up the precious metals for the cells, why don't we make them? And that's a good question.
Yeah.
I think the answer is partially what's the cost of doing that in Australia versus importing them from other places. But the other part is our manufacturing skill sets, which have been in decline for quite a while, and making cells is technically hard.
Right.
You need specialist engineers that can do that and, you know, have been trained to do that and have, there's an industry that they can do that in. So I think what it boils down to is we just couldn't get enough manufacturing engineers to do that kind of thing, unfortunately.
Will we over time? I know there are a few battery manufacturers here, but not many.
Yeah. No, I think there's not really a big kind of gigafactory sized thing building lithium cells that we'd be using in products. Maybe there's an argument for building more and more electric buses and trucks and having a feedstock of cells.
Yeah, with smart manufacturing now, it definitely seems like the cost of labor is becoming less of an influence of that.
That's right.
Because of robotics.
Yeah,
exactly. I'm trying to work out where that kind of goes in the future. But it would seem like, given the fact that we have this stuff buried in the ground, there's a unique opportunity.
Yeah. And it's a security thing as well.
Yeah.
Going back to the South China Sea equation, if we're importing a whole bunch of stuff or other countries are importing cells to then package them into vehicles and that supply chain stops, we're in trouble.
Yeah. Okay, why don't we I think context is really exciting, right? Just compare Australia to other markets.
Mm.
So from a car sharing point of view, how do you compare Australia and where we're at? And also, I think because we're talking about mass transportation.
I think it doesn't matter how you look at it, we're kind of lagging, especially on the passenger vehicle side.
Yeah,
I think, other countries, like you mentioned before, Norway and others have incentivized electric vehicles. Their uptake is starting to reach critical mass. You've got the Biden example in the States really pushing forward. That'll make a huge difference. London banning fossil vehicles from the metro area, only having electric, all of these types of things are happening in other places, unfortunately not here.
And do you think it will be like a switch going on? Or because I noticed that, Shenzhen, for example, they talked about how they migrated from diesel to electric 16,000 buses in a very, very short time frame. But obviously there's a lot of prep going into that.
Yeah.
Will it be like that or just be a really, really slow transition over the next decade or so?
I think it's going to be slower in Australia. I think you're going to have key projects that are going to be, ones that people focus on, and until one or two of those get going, then people need to see it, touch it to make it happen.
Okay. And I think one thing we haven't talked about, but, you kind of alluded to, was like AEV robotics.
Mm.
They're really kind of last mile stuff, aren't they? You can build on the platform, it could be delivery, I think they were looking at, or garbage pickup and stuff like that.
Mm.
There's a huge opportunity right there.
Yep. Yeah, last mile is important, but other use cases like garbage trucks is also really important. I mean, that's another huge opportunity. Every council that I've spoken to that run garbage truck fleets, the number of complaints they get about noise.
Yeah.
At 5 a.m. when the truck pulls up with its noisy diesel and empties your bin, like they'd love to get rid of that problem.
Yeah, I mean, they're all diesel too, aren't they?
They're all diesel.
Like, just the opportunity right there.
And they sit on the charger for the rest of the day.
Yeah.
So they just go out in the morning. So there's a lot of use cases like that. People are building electric platforms to, for commercial vehicles.
Yeah.
And you put a garbage truck body on the back.
Yeah.
But it is, there's a lot of work, a lot of integration, a lot of convincing people, because there's two sides to the coin. Commercial vehicles are great because they're commercial vehicles and there's suppliers making commercial vehicles and it's a commercial proposition by definition, but generally they have to work.
Yeah.
You're providing an essential service, you're transporting people, you're emptying rubbish bins, you're doing things that are pretty important.
Yeah.
So they can't fail, and that's why it's sort of swings and roundabouts with that type of project.
We talked about it a little bit also, but just obviously heavy vehicles and specific, you know, semis and mass transportation, which is huge in Australia as it is in the US.
Mm.
You know, obviously Tesla are coming out with something. I noticed that Uber sold their kind of autonomous freight division. Where do you see that going? I mean, how quickly would that evolve in Australia?
I think electric semis and trucks are going to be a segment. Whether they become fully autonomous quickly is another question. I think semi-autonomous, and then there was another company, I've forgotten the name, that were doing the nose-to-tail operations. So the trucks behind would just follow the lead truck.
Right.
And it became like a train of trucks going up the Hume.
Right.
Those models are all under development, but it's going to take quite a bit of time before legislation and other safety issues catch up.
And obviously the battery technology to be able to, you know, for them to travel 10 hours or 12 hours at a time.
Yeah, that's right.
Or
noting that obviously with a human driver, you can't drive that long by law.
Yeah.
You have to stop, which is good because you can recharge it, but autonomous vehicles will just go the whole way.
One thing I'm constantly surprised at in Australia is that mining is such a big vertical for us, and we have so much innovation going on in mining, but we don't, innovation bay-wise, we don't come across a lot because it seems maybe too enterprise-y, but there's a lot of mines now that are using electric vehicles.
Mm.
Is that an area that you guys are looking at?
Yeah, I think hydrogen and electric for mining is a big area. All the miners are motivated to, you know, a lot of the announcements that have been made, BHP and others, about, you know, zero carbon or negative carbon from various mining operations is all happening. And, you know, as we know, the transport carbon at the mine is a big part of the mine's emissions. So, they're all motivated to do it. But, again, it is a bit bits and pieces sort of happening.
Yeah.
I think there is opportunity there, though.
So, Nick, we're kind of wrapping up now, you know, and since this is becoming like an annual event for us, so I think we should do, before we get into the quickfire questions, something around thoughts on what's going to happen, you know, in the next year or 18 months that we can hold you accountable to. No, that, you know, we can just have a look back on maybe.
Mm.
What do you think? I mean, things accelerating very quickly.
I think within 12 months we'll get some stronger government support.
Right.
And I reckon there'll be, you know, hopefully more than one electric or hydrogen bus fleet, which, you know, is announced and starts to get rolled out in that time frame. That'll be a real kind of focal point for a lot of the rest of the industry. I think that's what will happen.
And I know that we were talking before and used to work for Holden, right? We've obviously moved all auto manufacturing out of the country. AEV is obviously starting to produce their electric vehicles here. Do you see that as an opportunity? You know, we're talking about Rivian before, which are an East Coast US business, right?
Mm. I'd love to say yes. I just think it's the same problem. It's going to involve government support to make it happen. And, you know, that was one of the arguments why it didn't survive, because it relied on government support, even though every other auto manufacturer in the world relies on government support.
Yeah.
I'm not sure that we'll ever get back to that point. Unfortunately.
Right. Okay. If you're government and you're listening, there you go. It's a good one. Well, why don't we jump into the quickfire questions then? I'm not sure if these have changed or evolved at all, but favorite book at the moment?
I'm reading a book by Barry Jones called What Is to Be Done, which is like a bit of a view on the politics of climate, if you like.
Okay. And how are you rating it?
It's good so far. I haven't finished it, but it's a good read.
Yeah,
it's a good summary.
Excellent. All right. What about podcast?
The Driven podcast, which is I think by the Renew Economy team,
and it's a great website.
Yeah, it's that's an EV specific podcast, which is very interesting.
And I hear there's something like 600 new models of EVs coming in the market in the next 5 years.
I think globally, there's a lot of stuff happening.
It's kind of amazing, isn't it? Mm. Hopefully, we'll see some of that trickle down here.
Hopefully.
Fingers crossed. News source?
ABC News.
Okay. Excellent. You can't really go past it, can you, as a platform? This is one of my best holiday location.
So,
that no one's traveling.
As you know, I'm a very keen mountain biker.
Yeah.
So, the best place, I think, that's not too far from where I live is a place called Forest, which is in the Otways in Victoria.
Yeah.
And that's terrific.
Really? Good mountain biking there?
Yeah. Good family location in the bush.
Right.
They brew beer.
Really?
It's hard to got mountain bike tracks, so they tick all the boxes.
Have you been to Derby yet? No, we had the conversation.
I'd like to.
Okay, that'll be interesting. Have you got a favourite founder or CEO?
Last time I said Elon Musk.
Yeah.
This time I'm going to change it to JB Straubel, who is the CTO of Tesla, who has just started a new venture after he's left Tesla called Redwood Materials.
Right.
And he's business is to eventually get back to the point where he can produce fresh, raw input materials for batteries from recycled batteries.
Oh, wow.
So it basically closes the loop.
Oh, amazing.
So you don't have to keep digging up more resources out of the ground.
Yeah, wow. Okay. Do you have a favorite productivity tool?
I do. Trello is my favorite tool. I love a good Trello board.
Yeah, great. Good Australian.
That's right.
Business now. And if you could do a TEDx talk, what would it be on?
I find it hard to go past some of the things we talked about. So how do you actually electrify the whole fleet and what are the pathways to doing so?
It's a very exciting stage, isn't it? We're at the moment. A lot of opportunity.
Definitely.
Nick Carter, thank you so much for the time and talking to us today. It's been great.
No worries. Thanks very much for having us.
Awesome.
Cheers.